Hi, this is photographer Sid Caesar.
This is Dave Say, graphic designer.
And welcome back to what we will hope will be many podcasts to come. And this is our second one, I think.
That's right.
Yay.
Count to two.
Dos. So the first one seemed to go pretty well. And the feedback seemed pretty decent. I got a few emails that said that they thought it was good and that our voices sound appropriate.
Yeah, except for that one comment about my voice sounding like helium at some point.
And you were trying to do your little, like a whiny person. Like, yeah. So he was actually just changing his voice.
Yeah, I don't whine very well, apparently. But,
well, that's good, though.
I guess so, yeah.
So what else has been going on? So we just had the last portable portrait workshop of the season.
How'd that go?
It went really well. There was a small turnout. We actually got rained out for the day, but that kind of opened up a bunch of new places that I wouldn't think of looking for location-wise otherwise. Mm. So we actually ended up doing a bunch of stuff in a couple of parking garages right here in Nashua.
That's a good thing to remember, that when you don't have an ideal situation, it forces you to become more resourceful.
Yeah, well, I cheesed out like the first one. We were supposed to have one in September, and I actually like let the rain beat me and actually canceled that one, and then we rescheduled the workshops that took place in October because of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I got a little scared the first time I did it. And I'm not, this is still kind of a new workshop for me, so I'm still sort of, it's organic, so it's sort of, I'm figuring out, how to do it as I go.
Mm.
So this time I was like, nah, screw it, we'll run it, we'll see what happens. And it actually worked out really well, because we started inside, and that wasn't going so hot, because I wanted to get outside. So once we got outside, I just started looking for areas that were covered. So we went into the first car parking garage that was behind Cameraland on Main Street in Nashua, and they had this great section that was just full of signs, like all these, like, do not do this sign, you have to park here sign, like all these instructional directional signs. So we just started shooting right there. We just set up a light, and we just started shooting Rob, our model, just right in the middle of all these signs. And I think they came out really, really good. And then on the way to the second parking garage location, the rain let up for a few minutes. So we did a quick setup, and we were behind Martha's Exchange in Nashua. And there was this one wall that was just all covered with vines and leaves and stuff. And so we got a couple of really good shots there.
Mm.
And then we moved it to the last parking garage area. And every level of the parking garage, if you were going up the stairs, was just this really disgusting, gaudy, fluorescent color. So there was like a fluorescent green and a fluorescent orange. And so once we found that was like, we hit pay dirt. We were just like, oh. And then Rob was really good. He started jumping around and hopping up and down and stuff. So we got some very, very good movement shots in there.
Yeah. What do you look for in a model?
Well, right now, just people that I know that I get along with, that I know that should be relatively easy to work with.
Mm-hmm.
With the workshops, I'm primarily working with my friend Vanessa. And that's just because we've worked together so many times that, we sort of got a rapport already. So she's really easy to work with. And then this guy, Rob, that modeled at the last one, he was kind of, I just took a chance and I've known him for a long time. And I was like, let's give it a shot and see. And he actually did really well. And it was nice that I could shoot a male for once. I don't primarily, a lot of the work going, if you look over a lot of the work, I don't have a lot of males in a lot of my work. And that's not really, it's not a conscious thing, but it's just sort of, that's the way it leads up. A lot of times I'm shooting primarily females. So I thought it would be nice to get at least one guy in one of the workshops where I can sort of shoot.
It's very egalitarian of you, Sid.
No. It's just, especially for the workshops, it's just Vanessa and I click so well that it's just sort of become like she's the standard, model. And I
yeah, you know each other's routines now.
Yeah. Mm. So that's good. And, and she looks forward to it too. She's always asking me when the next ones are going to be. And she likes, and it's good for her too, because during the workshops, it gives me a chance to shoot shots that she might be able to use for her modeling portfolio.
Right.
And at the same time, it gives a bunch of other people a chance to shoot somebody that's experienced being, sort of a model. So she sort of knows the poses already.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good. And so it gives them, sort of an experience to shoot somebody that's a little more quote unquote professional in the field.
Mm.
So it went really well. So I'm going to take the winter off, I think, and try to restructure it a little bit, or just sort of reflect on how the first four have gone. There's a couple of changes I can make I do a little refresher course before we get outside and shooting, and there's some visual things I can add to that to make it a little more interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And then hopefully starting next spring, we can sort of start to secure some classes for it. I know there's one already that's going to run sometime in April at the New Hampshire Institute of Art. So that's already slotted in. So that'll be good.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're working on taking it to other colleges and community colleges and stuff, you know, in the southern New Hampshire area. So hopefully that'll catch on.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, so this is like the fourth one. Is that what you said?
Yeah, so far there's been two in Manchester at NHIA, and then we've done two so far out of Cameraland right here in Nashua.
Mm-hmm. So, man, you're really rolling along.
Trying to.
How's it like when you? I remember when you were first starting to put together this workshop. You're all kinds of nervous.
I was so nervous.
Yeah, it's like. So, how do you feel now?
Good. More confident. More relaxed. The numbers have been. It's been interesting. You know, like the first one, we had 13 people, and the ones we're doing in Nashua, we're trying to keep it right around 6 to 8 people, so it's mm-hmm. a more manageable crowd.
Mm-hmm.
But it's good. I mean, it's making me more comfortable with getting in front of, you know, a group of people and doing it. So,
right.
I think the last couple of ones I've gotten pretty confident, especially once we get outside and shooting, because then I'm in shooter's mode. Mm. And a lot of it is just remembering to sort of explain what I'm doing as I'm doing it, you know, and then allowing enough time so that everybody else can have their turn and I can help them if they need it.
Right.
Yes.
No, ask me a question. I have no idea what to talk about.
So you are experiencing, you do these emergent task planners.
Oh, yeah.
You are notably famous for, and you've actually put them for sale up on Amazon now.
That's
so
right.
So this is a whole new thing for you.
Yeah, I guess that's my new thing. Like the whole idea grew out of when I read Timothy Ferris's book, The 4-Hour Workweek. I got an advanced copy way back, you know, before it was a bestseller.
Oh.
And I was really struck by the whole idea that I could have this passive residual income and that a lot of the stuff was outsourceable. So I figured what the thing I should do is, like, I knew that there were certain forms that were somewhat popular.
Yep.
And maybe people would pay for a really nice printed one, because, you know, I would.
Yeah.
And
You've had a lot of people download the ones that you've had online, right?
So yeah, yeah.
This is what brought you to the idea of
yeah, yeah. There was them. Yeah. So about it must be almost 3 years ago. Like I did a post asking to see if anyone would be interested in purchasing pre-printed ones, and if they were, to say how many they would order. And you know, so I made sure I had the enough of them for a minimum print run. You need to do about, I think it's like 10,000 sheets of paper.
Holy moly.
Yeah, so like it's the starting cost to getting into doing a print run of a single sheet design is about $1,000.
And
like I wanted to make sure I wasn't about to lose $1,000.
Right, right.
So like I had enough orders and I figured out like, you know, what percentage it would have to be, what sort of profit margin to give myself a buffer. And when I had that enough, I did the print run, and it took about 2 years to sell through.
Yeah.
You know, so, and I wasn't pushing it. I wasn't marketing it. I wasn't doing anything particularly to, I just wanted to see, like, on its own, what kind of rate of sale could I get from it. And, after that was done, like, this was the experience of doing, fulfillment. And what fulfillment means is, like, the process of you're getting an order, accepting payment.
Okay.
Shipping it to the recipient address.
Yeah.
And it turns out that there's quite a number of little steps involved in it. It's,
yeah.
Like for us, it's easy. Credit card, you know, bing, and it shows up at your door like a few days later. But when you're the one that's shipping the stuff, there's all kinds of stuff. Well, how do you accept payment? How do you accept a credit card? Well, you need something called a merchant account. I didn't know that was what it was called. And, well, how do you get a merchant account? Well, apparently there's a number of different ways you can do it. Either you go get it through a bank, which means you need to be an established business, or you can use something, I think it's called a payment gateway, or a company that provides these. They accept payment on your behalf, and they maintain all these accounts. So there's all these different ways.
Is that kind of like an escrow type thing?
I have no idea. But, you know, everyone has a different name for it. The easiest thing for me to do, I figured, was like, to use PayPal. PayPal
yep.
has like that Pay It Now button,
yep.
and they have a back-end interface that allows you to set up these little buttons that have all the kind of the codes that they use internally. PayPal uses internally to credit your account. Yeah, but that was slow too. And then plus, once you've accepted the money, you still need to like, you know, ship the thing,
box it up. Yep. And it's like earlier I used to go through phases where I'd sell a bunch of stuff on eBay, but I'd do it in like all one big thing. So I'd like have 24 things listed,
mm-hmm.
and then I'd forget about them for 7 days, and then all of a sudden they'd all close and people would all pay, and all of a sudden I had to box all this stuff up and mail it out.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's kind of like I sort of know, you know, just the pain in the butt of sitting there and sealing things up and writing down addresses. And
So what I ended up doing was like, well, PayPal actually has this convenient feature in which they'll actually accept their orders. And they will list, you know, you can actually buy postage through them.
Uh-huh.
So you can buy postage for like priority mail. So it turned out like the easiest, most cost effective way to ship stuff was through like flat rate priority mail.
Okay.
So I could do the flat rate envelope and it was like $9 or something like that. And then there's flat rate box, which is like, I forget, it's like $12. I'm probably completely wrong on this. But you can like pack one of those boxes, like with as many of these 10 of these pads, and it'd be the same price.
Mm-hmm.
Plus they come standardized, in sizes, so I can prepack them, which saves time when it's fulfillment time.
Right.
And also, they will actually ship you the empty boxes and envelopes for free. So like what you can do. So like I said, I need 100 of these things, and the post office said, okay, there's no cost in it because you're going to be using our service. These are the only things these boxes are good for.
Yeah.
And you're not supposed to use them for anything else. but once those were set up, then I had a pretty good workflow. And the other thing was like figuring out how to pack the things, you know, the boxes, so they wouldn't rattle around and get damaged.
Yep.
So I had to like, at first I bought, filling stuff, you know, like, you know, foam peanuts, bubble wrap. And it ends up being kind of expensive and a pain in the butt to use.
Yep.
So I invented my own packing system, involving a hot glue gun and some paper and some stamps, and it ends up being much cheaper and pretty secure. And it actually looks kind of cool. Anyone who's ordered the packages from before probably has seen it and wondered, like, you know, what the heck is this thing that's going on here? My computer just went to sleep.
Uh-oh.
And is it still recording? Apparently so.
Okay,
that looks good. So, long story short, this time I didn't want to do fulfillment anymore. It ended up being that to fulfill, if I was like flat out working on these things, I could fulfill maybe 6 to 8 packages an hour.
Wow,
that's including all the packing time, gluing, picking, and it's, you know, I suppose I could have eventually gotten it down to a science. But it's something I didn't really want to spend all my time doing.
Yep.
I think I worked out like the hourly rate was actually not bad. It was like $70 an hour, like for him. But I would have rather be doing something else than doing that. So this time I looked into using a fulfillment house. I looked into a local place here, which I should look up the name of.
Was it Paper Graphic? No.
No. Paper Graphics is the printer I used.
Keystone?
That's another printer.
I'll shut up.
Okay, just be quiet, man. They're right around the corner.
Alpha Graphics?
No, that's another print place.
Oh.
This is a
fulfillment. I'm naming every print place.
This is a fulfillment house.
Oh, okay.
And so, like, what they do is like you can warehouse your stuff there, and they'll pick and pack for you. But you still need to ship them the orders and all that sort of stuff. What I was looking for was an all-in-one solution.
Okay.
And I heard about Amazon Fulfillment. And what Amazon Fulfillment is it allows you to ship warehouse goods from Amazon's warehouse. So this is the ideal case. So I design something, I send it to the printer, the printer prints it and ships it to Amazon. It goes into Amazon's inventory system. This is one thing PayPal's system doesn't do. It doesn't do inventory. So you're constantly checking to see if you have any left. So this was something I was always worried about. Like, I'd run out of inventory and PayPal wouldn't tell me.
Yeah.
Plus PayPal's back end is very, very slow. Their administrative interface is very tedious to work with. You're just waiting and waiting and waiting for it to like update. It's slow. I hate slow stuff. So it took a while to like figure out how to navigate Amazon's fulfillment system.
Mm-hmm.
Because like a lot of this merchant and shipping stuff uses a lot of the concepts and terminology can be confusing for someone who's never done this stuff. Like, you know, what is a merchant account? Yeah. What does FOB stand for? Stuff like that. I'm still not sure what that is.
FOB.
Yeah, it's related to like how you receive goods, and what you do with them once you receive them. But anyway, so it turns out to use Amazon, you need to get a pro merchant account, which allows you to list goods on Amazon's website.
Okay.
There's another feature called the Amazon Store, which you don't need. And then you need to sign up for Fulfillment by Amazon, FBA.
Wow.
And then set these options. And then there's other ways of selling, too. There's like Seller's Advantage, or I can't remember what it's called. But if you have an Amazon account as an individual, you can actually list stuff on there like eBay. If you have some books to sell, you can just list them, and they'll accept the orders for you, and you do the fulfillment. In my case, I wanted Amazon to do all my fulfillment, so I chose Fulfillment by Amazon as opposed to multi-channel fulfillment, which is like Amazon can fulfill some stuff, but you can fulfill other things.
Okay.
And then you do the regular thing. You accept the order, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
The cool thing about this is Amazon accepts payment on your behalf. They handle the shipping. And it all works through the Amazon.com system.
Huh.
I just need to ship stuff to Amazon, have it stickered so they can identify each stock keeping unit.
Okay.
And they will provide their own stock keeping unit if you don't have one. Like ordinarily you would have to get something like a UPC code.
Yeah.
And, UPCs cost, if you join the GS1, which is the international organization that allocates these codes, it's like $800 to join and then $100 a year, like minimum, to be able to issue those UPC codes. Those are those codes in the backs of cereal boxes that you get scanned.
Okay.
So every product you sell has a unique one. So they scan, and this is how they keep track of stuff. If you don't have that, then Amazon can't move it through their inventory system. So you have to get the Amazon stock keeping unit number.
Yeah.
If you don't have one of those, or you buy a UPC code through a reseller, from anywhere between $20 or $50 per code. But since I'm selling through Amazon, it turns out you don't need it. You just use their number, and then you put a sticker on every product you're selling.
Hmm.
So I guess that was kind of long-winded, but
so it's working though. Or you,
it's working.
They've got your stuff, and you said that there was a fulfillment center that's 3 miles down the road or something, or there's a warehouse.
There's a warehouse for local New England, but they tell you what warehouse you're supposed to send to. The one that I sent to is in Indiana someplace.
Really?
So so I sent 9 boxes of 25 each, 225 pads. Since posting it, I've sold 20 pads, or 25 pads, I think.
Nice.
So there's 200 left there. And they actually got my first check from them for $180.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. So it's So the system theoretically works. Whether or not I lose my shirt on it, it still remains to be seen. But
and
I
how much
still
you selling for?
$12.50.
At $12.50.
$12.50 each.
And you sold 20.
Sold 20, 25. So the costs. There are costs, of course, involved with Amazon fulfillment.
Yeah. So they're taking.
There's a 15% commission fee that they take for the particular kind of good I'm selling, which is office supplies.
Okay.
There is a per order handling fee of $1. There is then a per pound handling fee of 40 cents per pound. am I missing something? I'll write about this at some point on the website.
So they cut you a check for 180. So if I did 1250 times 25, that gives me 312.50. And then you get almost 200 out of that.
Well, something like that.
That's still not too bad, though. I mean, considering you've done all the hard work already, now you just sit back and
collect
the checks.
I really had to remodel the finances on this. I'm using my old numbers, and so I had summed up. It ended up being I think $4 or $5 per pad in terms of costs.
Huh.
And that includes shipping. I don't remember. Huh. I don't remember anything. But this is the whole point. I just want to know that this stuff is just making me money. I'll just eventually look in there and say, oh, there's money coming in. Cool. Awesome. And that's the way I want it to be.
Now, what made you set on the $12.50 pricing?
Originally, it was based on the cost of printing, mm-hmm. plus the estimated cost of packaging and fill, you know, the bubble wrap or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And then shipping, I didn't factor in because people would just pay for their own shipping
right.
on top of it.
Right.
I also looked at, compared it to the cost of, if you're printing these forms out on your inkjet printer, your per page cost. I was looking at similar products in the stores, like, you know, what other premium stationery products we're going for. If you look at a Daytimer refill, you know, they want a ludicrous amount of money for those things. And so I said, well, I can charge a ludicrous amount of money, but I did feel good about that. So I ended up settling, $12.50 is about right. And so, like, and since I'm not doing, like, you know, huge volumes, I had to actually make sure I have a pretty large profit margin. So in my case, it's about 100%.
Okay.
So, like, because you have all these other additional costs and things like that, as, like, I figure out the real finances behind this thing and volumes go up, then I can lower prices and be more competitive.
Yeah.
In the meantime, I have a pretty big safety buffer in there. And I think the pricing I came up with is, like, you know, it's a little bit pricier than if you're buying generic stationery,
mm-hmm.
but it compares very favorably with other products, you know, like especially Daytimers in the case of the Emergent Task Planner. The paper is good. I got the best, most durable paper I could for the price. It's a nice, like a thick, opaque, feels good in the hand, I thought.
Yeah.
I'm using like custom specified inks. And they're on these they're glued on a cardboard as like these pad things to make them convenient.
Yeah.
And they're shrink wrapped. And so all those things cost money. Just feeling it out. And that's kind of where it is right now. In the next stage, I need to write all the documentation for it in a form that's more mainstream accessible.
Okay.
Yeah. Because right now it's like it's still a kind of niche product.
Yeah,
you know, in that it's like only people who have heard of it know what it is or know how it works, and even then, like they're just making it up as they go along because I've never systemized any of the printable CEO stuff. They're all like basically little thought experiments that I've created all under one umbrella name. But they can be put together into a workflow system. I haven't specified an official one because, you know, these are experiments. I post them very clearly as that, and people will use them as they will. But for a mainstream product, people expect to have some notion of how you're supposed to use it or how you can use it. Some examples so they can wrap their mind around
Tell
it.
Tell us how to use it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. That's where that is.
Very cool.
Very cool.
Very cool. And those can be found on Amazon.
Yep, those can be found on Amazon. Let's see.
Well, we just had a visit from our buddy Travis, or my buddy Travis, who you just officially got to meet.
Yep.
And he came by because he's been getting heavily involved with this Granite State Skeptics group that I don't know if he created it or he's associated himself with it, and now he's sort of taking center stage.
Mm-hmm.
So that's he cool. came by, and it seems like it's pretty active. So he wanted, I said, just for the hell of it, for him to stop by, and we could take some shots of him. He wanted something so that, you know, if he's I guess he's been getting more active of, like, blogging through the Granite State Skeptics website and stuff. So he just wanted, like, a little visual thing about him. So if you click on it, you know. So we did a little quick setup of him kind of sitting at a little table, and he brought his little netbook with him.
Mm-hmm.
It has all these skeptic stickers on the front and stuff. So we opened that up. And then it was kind of cool because you got to watch us. We just sort of did a little setup, and then we just kind of organically figured out where we wanted the lights and everything. And we ended up going for this kind of nice little – I had a little tiny speed light that I was resting on the keys of his laptop, and we sort of aimed the light at the screen, and then the screen would bounce this light into his face.
Mm-hmm.
And we took a little clear plastic gel that you can put on the front, like a theatrical gel that you cover the light with. So we took this real deep blue kind of light, and we put that on top of the flash, and then so it looks like this nice on the front of him because he's looking at the laptop. there's this nice blue glow in the front of him, and you can sort of see these blue squares in his glasses. So it looks like this, you know, this nice deep blue is kind of glowing from the laptop into the front of him. And then we sort of lit him from the back a little bit to separate. Yeah. So it was kind of fun. It was just, you know, he just kind of came by. I wanted to say hi, and and we lit him kind of nicely, and he got to go home with some cool pictures that, you know, he put on his new website now as becomes, you know, New Hampshire's bona fide skeptic person, professional skeptic.
It was interesting to watch that session because, like, you know, like in the past, like you and I have been talking about, well, how do you price things? And like, you know, like a studio type shoot, you know, there's a lot that goes into it. I mean, there's light setups. I mean, even if you're using stand-ins, that's still time, that's still money you need to pay the person to do the stand-in work. You know, stand-in being someone that just puts, so you can set up the lights properly. So when the actual, you know, client comes in, you can just put them in place. He doesn't spend a lot of time.
Yeah, they don't have to deal with all of the standing around and tweaking stuff.
Right. So, and you can see now that if people don't know that, like, a lot of people think that like photographers just press this button and they have these magical lights. And like, because it seems like a button press thing, you shouldn't really charge a whole lot of like for it. You know, the same thing like when you're doing like interactive stuff or web stuff, people think, oh, the computers are so easy. This is probably Apple's fault. You're like, so, oh, I can use iWeb or I can use things like, and I can just make my thing. And, but it is easy if you do that. But invariably people also want something that's custom. That's not exactly like that. And then that's where it gets expensive.
Yep.
But, well, because it's in iWeb, I just press this button. You must have just like this other button that I don't get to see, like the teacher's edition button that, you know, makes it easy. And so why should I pay you for this?
Yep.
You know, so that's, you know, that just kind of, how do you make that kind of stuff visible to people? And, whether or not it's even like a battle you can fight.
You have to sort of figure out where it becomes, because you don't want to sort of kvetch about it so much, because then it sounds like you're complaining about it.
Yep.
But I think it's good that, you know, that's why, like, I don't know if I've got any videos up online that show me actually, you know, setting lights up and stuff. But, you got to see it. It was kind of an organic process. And then what I thought was basically going to be a one-light job, we actually had one, two, three. We had four or five lights going. You know, we had certain light over here to catch the back of his head. And we had this one that was pointed directly at the front of the computer. Mm-hmm. So you're sort of crafting everything as you go. And you know, you're adding it piece by piece and seeing where it goes. And that's sort of, you know, there's a lot of time that gets involved in that.
Yep.
So, like, if I've got a corporate client and they want something shot on a completely white background, I know that, you know, that's right to start with. That's a three-light setup. Mm-hmm. So I know I have to get that set up before he comes in, because he doesn't want me I don't want him standing there while I'm trying to arrange the two backlights so that we can blow the background completely white, so that, you know, if somebody wants to go in and sort of in Photoshop and sample him, select him and remove him from the background, and he's not going to, you know, I've known with corporate clients, they want to come in, they want their shot, they want to leave. They want to spend as less time as possible, because, you know, they're doing important things too, and time is money for them. I find that, you know, especially with studio stuff, it's important to get the shot beforehand. And luckily I've got, you know, like Sarah, you know, she doesn't mind sitting on a stool while she's reading, and I can set everything up while she's just kind of hanging out, you know, and that way we'll come in and get everything ready. And then the next day all I need to do is come in and turn the camera on and turn the lights on, and we're pretty much set.
That really well.
And it isn't that convenient? That,
like,
you know,
oh,
just
I'm content to sit here and read my book. You're doing me a favor.
you do whatever you want, and I'm going to be involved in my book world. And
wow.
So it's, you know, it's, I lost my train of thought, what I was going to say, but there's a process behind that. And it's, you know, it's not them just walking in and you clicking, you know, here you go, here's your shot, I mean, my check. You know, everything is sort of tailored to what they need. And when you're dealing and it's completely different from if you were doing event type stuff, you're not dealing with all kinds of lights and all kinds of setups and stuff like that. So the way you structure your pricing might be a little different. You know, but most of the time with studio, I like to use a lot of lighting. So that just means that my price, I have to factor that into the price, that it's not the, you know, the 10 minutes that they come in and take a shot. It's, it's leading up to that. It's me getting the gear ready. It's me getting everything set up. It's me doing all the test shots. Then it's the shot. Then they leave. Then it's me sitting down and, you know, sort of going through the images that we took, and it's me processing stuff and delivering the files. And there's just more to it than just that sort of magical 10 minutes that happens.
Right. So we should talk about something fun too.
Okay. Yeah, we should delve into, like, you know, something that'll get us, like, heated up or something.
Yeah,
like your lack of appreciation for Christoph Gans's Brotherhood of the Wolf, which
I think is
a fantastic movie.
I think I have exactly the right amount of appreciation for this
movie. No, you don't have the kind of appreciation that this movie deserves. See, this is where we're going to turn into like Siskel and Ebert, and I'm going to have to jump across the table and smack you upside the face a couple of times. Actually, I'm going to bring in a copy of the movie, and I'm going to smack you with the movie.
I'm just going to let you win because I don't want to watch it again.
I don't understand that. I do not understand.
I saw enough of it. It looked like it's
awesome. That movie rocks. I don't understand how you don't like that
movie. When did they make that? Like in 1983
or something? No! Oh, 1983. No. I don't even remember when they made it. Like 2002? 2003?
Really?
I can't even remember because I'm so blinded by the awesomeness of that movie.
Yeah, well, maybe I saw the wrong version.
Right.
I mean, like I just remember like little fits and pieces. There was...
How can you... like? It's everything, especially as somebody that's like, okay, so like I'm into kung fu and I'm into like weird Victorian period pieces, and then we've got this dude that looks like David Lee Roth, and then it turns out the guy from the Iron Chef is actually like this kick-ass martial arts guy who can pass off kind of as an Indian like he did in the movie. And it's like it's got everything, and then it's got creatures and Jim Henson's Creature Shop, and it's got this dude with a mutated arm that he like keeps strapped under his back, and he's got a bone sword that like it's like Mortal Kombat, and it's like the Muppets, only like twisted Muppets, because you got that thing with the thing and the jaws, and it's like all metal and it's crunching, it's going around killing people, and then it's like this whole, you know, murder mystery because nobody knows who done it, and then you've got all this secret cult with all the guys in the red costume. It's so over the top. And it's like everything. It's like the guys, you could just see the guy and he's like writing it down, and all of a sudden he's got this other idea, you know, and he's like, so we're in Victorian times and we have this man who's partnered with an Indian. Like, and then like, you know, he's like dot, dot, dot. And he's like, and the Indian knows kung fu. Excellent.
You see, it sounds like it should be good.
And so people are being murdered in this small town. So these two gentlemen decide to go. Well, one of them who's like, you know, who's forensic. So he's going to go and study these dead bodies. And he brings his companion with him, who happens to be the Kung Fu Indian. And so they get this little town. And then they find out there's this giant beast, lion, crazy monster thing that's killing people. Therein lies the mystery. And then it just goes from there, and it's like over the top, and it gets crazier and crazier. And then there's like slow motion scenes where they're kicking people in the rain, and they're knocking each other with staffs. How you cannot like this movie is beyond me. I do not understand this.
Movie then shot by some like first year film student.
Not a first year film student.
maybe it's a
Matrix
final
is shot
project.
By first year film student.
Final
students.
Project.
This
film
movie
student.
Is
it's like,
awesome.
Like, how do we portray awesomeness in martial arts? Let's use a lot of fast intercuts to mask the lack of martial arts choreography and actual ability. And like a
crack. This man is on crack.
Yeah, like conceptually, I can see where you're coming from, but it's just the portrayal of it. Like, I just can't get by. Like,
And then what else? Monica Bellucci, like one of the most voluptuous women on the planet. So you got to squeeze her. Like, it's got everything.
I can appreciate her in isolation.
It's got hot chicks. It's got this guy that looks like David Lee Roth, and suddenly he comes out and he starts kicking ass, and this like kicking ass and this kicking ass. And then everybody's kicking ass, and then there's monsters kicking ass, and they're eating people. And then there's that dude at the end, and he's got the thing with the arm, and it's all gross. It's like all tetsuo'd out, and it's turning, mm-hmm. and he's got his sword, and it's made out of bone, and it like comes apart, and he's like cutting people's cheeks and stuff with it because it's so sharp and it's bone, and they're smashing it, like they're knocking, like it's so like he can hit a thing in a graveyard, and then it like breaks. It's awesome. It's awesome.
Okay, you win. If you say so. I'm still not going to watch it again. I mean, unless I need a good nap. I think I took two.
I'm exhausted. That movie leaves me visually just exhausted. There's so much going on.
It might be also just this weird lack of story. I mean, I found like each scene individually maybe kind of interesting, but the way they link together, well, they didn't. It's a bunch of stuff that happens.
No, it's not. It's all going on because he got sent there from, you know, from like the King of England, and he's supposed to go and find out what's doing all the killing, and they think it's like a wolf, and it's not really a wolf because, you know, and then it turns out it's this thing, and it's like, you know, giant and all CG, and part of it's like from Jim Henson's Creature Shop, so it's like this big giant thing, and it's got these metal fans. It's awesome. Awesome. Awesome sauce.
Well, I'll go... If you bring it in, I'll watch it and see, like, if, and maybe that's what's going to work. Cause, like, I just realized that, like, the way we're describing this, if no one's ever seen it, like, we've already lost them. They have no idea what
it's
we're
like,
talking about.
Yeah, it's just, like, listening to me, like, get all, you know, like, all high voiced and,
I forgot what I was talking about.
You're wrapping it up.
I'm wrapping it up.
Wrap it up, Dave.
So, thanks for listening. This is Dave Say.
This is Sid Caesar.
And that's a wrap.
And that's a wrap. And to quote Dave, good night and good luck. Good night and good luck.